Hello and welcome to Scurvy Companions, the No Sweat Shakespeare podcast. My name is Emily, and today I'll be speaking with Corey Lee Smith and Elise Sharp of the Shakespeare Anyone podcast. You may remember Corey and Elise from when they joined us last season to discuss Macbeth and demonology during King James's reign. Both professional actors themselves, Corey and Elise dive into Shakespeare scholarship, breaking down his plays into incredibly researched detail without, as they say, the bardolatry. Their topics include King Lear and Shakespeare's influence on early psychiatry, gender and queer theory in Twelfth Night, and more. They also have many episodes devoted to scholarship outside specific plays, including episodes on Shakespeare's folios and quartos, food and cooking in early modern England, and more. Today, they join us to discuss how Shakespeare's plays were performed at court, meaning before the monarch and the nobles. We'll discuss the mechanics of court performances, how performances changed when they were inside at court rather than outside at the Globe Theatre for the public, and how playing before the nobility allowed a chance for political commentary. Without further ado, here are Corey and Elise. Hello, Corey and Elise. Thank you both for joining us so much.
Hi, thank you for having us back.
Yes, thank you, Emily.
So excited to have you back. We had so much fun with your episode on King James and demonology and Macbeth last season. So tell us a little bit about what brings you here today. What are we going to be talking about with Shakespeare and the court?
We're going to be talking more about how Shakespeare's plays were performed not just at the Globe Theatre or at the Blackfriars Theatre, not just at theatre in general, but how it looked like when he went on the road, so to speak, to court.
Right. And so this is when he's performing for the king or queen, depending on who is reigning, right?
Correct. Yeah.
And so where are some of these locations? Are we talking about palaces? Is it the same place?
Yeah, it's pretty much anywhere the king or the queen might hang out. You could consider that court.
Yeah, Hampton Court is pretty much where Elizabeth hung out. James moves court to Whitehall Palace.
But then you also do see them at like the Middle Temple Hall where the lawyers will see theater, and that is also considered like plays for the court.
And what determines if a play gets performed at court?
Oh, by request.
Mm-hmm. So of the monarch?
Of the monarch, yeah. So it wouldn't be necessarily like Elizabeth saying, I want to see Romeo and Juliet, but she would say to her master of revels, we're having this event. I want the Lord Chamberlain's men, at the time Shakespeare's theater company, to perform. And then the master of revels would go to the theater company and say, you've been picked. And then they'd work out together. And the master of revels was kind of in charge of planning the entertainment and figuring out what was going to be the night's entertainment. If you think about, if you're familiar with Midsummer Night's Dream and you think about Philostrate, that character, how Philostrate has that list of plays and the mechanicals go, our play is preferred. That is that job. Here are our options for what we can see tonight. But Elizabeth specifically maintained a very tight reign over and control over who got to perform at Hampton Court. And James, of course, made himself patron of Shakespeare's company. So he was just a big fan. And she would indicate which ensembles musicians she wanted to hear. And the master of revels would work out with the performers what exactly was going to be performed.
And I believe that the monarch could also provide preferences to the master of revels.
Oh, yes.
But the master of revels was the go-between between the monarch and the players.
Okay. And how did the monarch hear about these different companies? Is it, you know, who her nobles were patrons of often, or how did she go about selecting them?
I think that's also part. So the Master of Revels' job was to, that position also collected fees for the licensure of plays. So to be able to perform a play, it had to be licensed by the Master of Revels. So the Master of Revels also kept a close finger on the pulse of what groups were out there, what plays existed. So if the monarch says, hey, I want a comedy, what's good right now? The master of revels could go, here's some options. Okay, let's see that. And then eventually, you know, you have a few performances by a company and you get your preferences. Yeah.
And of course, there is also courtiers who would have some influence as well. I know that someone I'm going to talk about in a little bit, Robert Dudley, the Earl of Leicester, was a patron of the arts, and he was instrumental in organizing the Queensmen. And so he would have been someone that Elizabeth could have gone to and wanted to know, if she wanted to know, who should we have at court? I don't know if they did have those conversations, but the courtiers were close to her as well. So if you're a patron of the arts, that could also have some sway.
Right, that makes sense. And then do we know which plays of Shakespeare's were performed at court and which the most often? Were there common requests?
That's a really great question. So there's like two parts. So like we do know some, but oftentimes records weren't kept of like which exact play, only that, you know, the Kingsmen are performing on this day. We do know that Shakespeare and his company did perform a lot, roughly three times a year at Elizabeth's court. And she definitely saw Love's Labour's Lost and Merry Wives of Windsor, because those two plays, when they were published, had it written on their title page that they are published as they were performed before the Queen. And then there's also this traditional story, who knows how true it is, that she loved Falstaff so much that that Merry Wives was written at request of her, because she wanted to see a play that Falstaff was like the star of, where he fell in love. So presumably she also saw the Henrys, if we believe that story to be true. And she definitely had a preference for comedies, though. And then with James's court, the Kingsmen performed there about 10 times a year. And records show that James's court definitely saw The Comedy of Errors, Henry V, Love's Labour's Lost, Measure for Measure, Merry Wives of Windsor, Othello, probably A Midsummer Night's Dream, and The Merchant of Venice twice. Mm-hmm. So like from what we have, it's kind of a three-way tie for Merchant, Merry Wives, and Love's Labour's Lost.
Those are some good ones. And tell me about, you know that on the cover pages it says that it was performed before the Queen. Is there anything left in the script that might indicate like how it would have been done at court, or any differences between performing it, you know, outside of the Globe or in at court?
Right. So I think there's two parts of like, were there differences when it was performed at court? And then can we find like remnants of that in the script, right?
Right.
So there were some differences. They could use music more. But in terms of like how the plays were produced, the Elizabethan theatrical vehicle was pretty flexible. So the production quality came not from like big sets and like set changes and special effects, although there were special effects, don't get me wrong. But a lot more attention was paid to costumes and some props. And we know from records from another theater company of the time that they kept costumes and props in storage and organized by play, so that if a play was requested that was for the court, they could go to their storage and just grab the Merry Wives costumes. And that's like the majority of the production design that they have. There's also like cannons and for like sound effects to make thunder. And we do know that when those were performed indoors, the big difference would be that the smell of gunpowder and sulfur would definitely linger longer. So Macbeth and Henry VIII, probably not like the best smelling to perform at court. but I think the big difference, and one thing that we can see as a artifact of these plays for the court in terms of like the script, most obviously, is music. So music was much more popular when they were performed at court. You know, there's some Shakespeare plays that really feel like musicals in the versions that we have. And then changes, there are some editorial changes that we can see between quartos and folios that may be due to performing at court and needing to make changes, or again, like adding a song, or changing some language because it's now going to be performed at court.
Yeah, and I'm thinking of Twelfth Night, which was performed at court for Elizabeth. And Twelfth Night is filled with stage direction for music and references to music. So one could be like, oh, that must have been performed at court first because, or they must have been utilizing music because they were indoors versus outdoors at the Globe Theater where there's rowdy audiences and you're dealing with the elements. So,
And specifically with Twelfth Night, it being written for a Twelfth Night celebration where those stage directions for music are really probably other musicians that were part of the bill of entertainment that night at the court.
Yeah, tell me about that other entertainment. What else was performed in addition to these plays?
We have, musicians, like we were saying. Mm-hmm. And then there's another theatrical tradition called masks, which we can also see in Shakespeare's plays. Masks are not exactly the same as plays. They're a little bit more like movement, dance-based.
Very extravagant.
Yeah, very extravagant. For any like American theater history nerds, like think The Follies instead of like your traditional Shakespeare play.
Sure.
And they're filled with allegorical and they're usually allegorical and then filled with mythological and symbolic worlds where plays are more about real people dealing with real things. Masks were like the gods are discussing morality. And they have like concepts as characters. So there's truth, zeal, and error in Middleton's The Triumphs of Truth. And if you think about, if you're wondering like kind of what this looked like, there are moments in Shakespeare's plays, I mentioned this a little bit earlier, where just all of a sudden there are like gods coming down and like blessing a wedding. And it's like,
yeah, like Tempest.
Yes. So that's fascinating. Corey just shared this with me yesterday.
Yeah, I just found out something that blew my mind. So I found out that in, I think it was 1605, 1606, that Twelfth Night celebration, James had a court mask at one of the Twelfth Night holiday events. Mm-hmm. And at this, over the holidays, there was also a wedding because he was marrying off like the Earl of Essex's like nephew to some other lady of court, and it was a political marriage. The big thing that was really exciting to me was that Ben Jonson was asked to write a mask called Hemini. And this court mask, scholars believe Shakespeare saw because it comes back in The Tempest. And it's a line that most people assume to be referring to the Globe Theater. But in fact, this could be a moment where Shakespeare is commenting on masks in his plays. So there is a scene in Hemini where there are lords and ladies and they are doing a dance of sorts. And Inigo Jones, the architect, built this big globe set piece. And it was in the middle of the stage during the mask. And then all of a sudden, once there's some dancing that concludes, the globe comes down and we see in The Tempest a wedding, and at the wedding between Miranda and Ferdinand, Prospero has this line. He says, quote, "And like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, and the great globe itself, yeah, all which it inherit shall dissolve, and like this insubstantial pageant, faded, leave not a rack behind," unquote. And most people assume that the globe is a reference to the Globe Theater. But in fact, with the pageantry of the wedding, the mask references in the text, and the knowledge that there was a globe in this performance, Shakespeare very well could have been writing about a mask that Ben Jonson wrote for King James in 1605.
Yeah. And in that scene in The Tempest, there's also like gods, like Ceres comes down to bless the wedding. So it's like the performance of a mask and potentially talking about this mask that Ben Jonson wrote and directly referencing it.
So Shakespeare was performing at court, and Shakespeare was also writing about performances at court, especially at a time where the court mask was becoming more popular than bringing a traditional comedy or tragedy, a stage play, to the court.
Another fun fact about masks is that they allowed women to perform in masks because masks were considered private or amateur. And so elite women actually participated. They were often more dancers and in like those dancing those dancing movement based roles. Whereas like if the character of Truth in the Triumphs of Truth by Middleton needed to speak, a man would be saying lines. Men would be cast in characters that had lines, but masks were more movement based, and so women were performing on stage in these.
That's incredible. And then let's move a bit to the nobility that you were talking about that they're performing in front of. Who were some of these folks? You were talking about Robert Dudley.
One thing that I found very fascinating when looking at plays for the court was some historicism that I found. I'm just going to straight up say the book I took that I took all of my information from is Age and Love, Shakespeare and the Elizabethan Court by Jacqueline Van Hout. And in this book, Jacqueline peels back all of these layers about who these plays were, who was seeing the plays, but also more importantly, who we can see mirrored in these plays. So the plays would have been performed for Elizabeth and her court. They would have been performed for lawyers. And there's so much context. There's so much in this, in these plays that are truly for the 1590s kids, is what I like to say. That once you start to, see how pop culture and public figures influence these plays, it's mind-blowing. So these courts and the courts and the lawyers were watching these plays, and because of this, early modern playwrights and satirists would not have used heavy-handed identification of public figures or events in their plays, because that could lead to repercussions. And so they used a what Van Hout calls a glancing allusion, or what Hamlet called an abstract. So the public figure is being fragmented into multiple forms, or conflated into conflating different targets into one form. And my favorite one is Robert Dudley, the Earl of Leicester. And he was a controversial figure in the time. Robert Dudley was a older court favorite of Elizabeth's. And Elizabeth's court was also controversial at the time during her the later era of her reign, because she was a female monarch and she was confined by a patriarchal system, and the men around her were required to reverse the gender roles in order to succeed. And Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester, did this spectacularly. He was a figure who violated culture's gendered ideals of gender decorum as well as generational decorum, because older people, people of a certain age, were not supposed to be thought of as lustful or sexual or romantic. They were not lovers.
Like the Ages of Man speech from As You Like It. Like, that was very, like, closely held belief by some early modern people, was that, like, you have these phases of life, and once you are done with that phase of life, you move on.
Rigid. Yeah, for sure.
So a little bit of context for Robert Dudley, and then I've got some piping hot scalding tea.
Oh, good.
And so Robert Dudley, he is about the same age as Elizabeth. When Elizabeth ascended to the throne, he had political ties. His father, John Dudley, was an English general and politician who ruled the English government during the reign of young Edward VI. So Robert Dudley was politically entangled in the English political life. And when Elizabeth ascended to the throne, his fortunes took off and he was appointed Privy Counselor, and he was one of the Queen's favorites. And Dudley was also an active suitor of Elizabeth. He once proposed to her over a period of 3 weeks when Elizabeth came to visit him at Kenilworth Castle in 1575. Allegedly, he had their portraits painted, and then he had them covered with curtains, and he swore he was not going to reveal the portraits until Elizabeth accepted a marriage proposal. And she did not accept the marriage proposal, so it's assumed that she never saw these portraits. But we can go see them in museums. They're called the Kenilworth Portraits.
Wow. So, what a drama king.
Yeah, so I know. Yeah. And people in Elizabethan England took notice of Robert Dudley and had opinions about his relationship to Elizabeth, especially as he got older. So public interest in the Queen's love affair was a really popular topic for people of the time. She was the Virgin Queen. Right. And so we saw this interest in her love life, as well as her alleged lovers, in the form of rumors, images, unpublished and published poems, treatises, plays, and performances. And Shakespeare certainly took this character and sprinkled him throughout his plays. Mm. Dudley died in 1588 before Shakespeare was writing plays. However, he does have a connection to Leicester in the fact that Leicester was the premier theatrical patron, and Shakespeare's peers, James Burbage of the theater and comedian Will Kemp, were liveried under the Earl's old traveling troupe. And like I said, the Earl was instrumental in putting together the Queen's Men. So a lot of his future colleagues had worked with Leicester before. I'm going to call him Leicester from now on. And Leicester was parodied in many of his plays, and we focused on Twelfth Night. So I'm going to talk about his presence in the character of Malvolio from Twelfth Night. So Malvolio is a obvious, well, for the listeners who are not familiar with Twelfth Night, he is the Countess Olivia's steward. And during the play, he gets mocked and ridiculed for believing that this counterfeit letter was written by his countess. And so then, because of that, he makes a fool of himself. And that's how the Elizabethan public viewed Leicester. One example of Leicester in Twelfth Night is the bear baiting theme that's woven into the play. Many think it's like a relationship between theater and bear baiting. However, another look at that, at bear baiting, we would see that this staff of office that Leicester holds is of the bear and the ragged staff. Mm-hmm. So this is a heraldic emblem or badge that he carried. And so this insignia seems to be a reference to Malvolio.
Wow.
And and a second example, which is my favorite, comes from Sir John Harrington's controversial pamphlet, A New Discourse on a Stale Subject, or the Metamorphosis of Ajax from 1596. Ajax retails Count Gossip while detailing methods for disposal of human waste. And that's because Sir John Harrington, who was a courtier and the ancestor to Game of Thrones' Kit Harrington, is the inventor of the toilet.
No way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. One particular passage in Ajax upset Elizabeth. It explains how he, Harrington, wishes, due to his great invention of the flush toilet, quote, that he may one day be put into the Chronicles, or the Holinshed's Chronicles, as good members of our country, more worthily than the Great Bear, unquote. And later in the pamphlet, Harrington advocates using the Chronicles as toilet paper. So what he's saying is he's exposing his opinions of the Great Bear Leicester's attempts to go down in history as something that you could, you know, wipe your bum with.
Oh my gosh.
And I, because I have invented a toilet, I deserve to be in there more than this bear guy.
Yep.
Yep. You know what?
Fair. Precisely. And then the last one I'm going to share is a reference that comes from the cryptic forged letter that Mariah based Malvolio with.
Yeah.
It's very likely a reference that can be spotted in Ajax. The letter incites Malvolio to act on his sociosexual fantasies, becoming Count Malvolio through the riddle M-O-A-I. Mm-hmm. And Peter Smith argues that the riddling M-O-A-I in Mariah's letter comes from the Metamorphosis of Ajax. And that might not seem possible if we're using contemporary spelling as our guide. However, early modern spelling separates the A and the Jax into two separate words. And in early modern writing, the letter J looks like an I. So M for metamorphosis, O for of, A for A, and I for Jax. M-O-A-I. Shakespeare might have added So that's one way that we see, like, this pamphlet that was slandering Leicester show up in Shakespeare as a possible indication that Shakespeare was taking a bit of a piss, a if we're going to go with potty humor,
that's okay.
at Leicester.
And then Malvolio does not get the joke.
No, not at all. No, when I heard that on your podcast, it completely opened up that scene for me, because that's always been a little bit of a sticking point. That doesn't quite fit if I were to crush this a little, as Malvolio says, but yes.
Yeah. If you were to fold, you mean if you were to fold up the paper like toilet paper?
And crush it a little.
Mm-hmm. And there's also a reference to, or there's a line that says, and thus she makes her great peas.
Yes.
And that might also have been taken from Harrington's discussion of the queen's great peas, or human waste pea. And then the criticism of men of judgment might be the lawyers of Middle Temple who were watching Twelfth Night at this performance in Middle Temple Hall.
Wow. Oh, that's
so
incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, we see Shakespeare and satirists like him taking these references to other texts and taking apart a public figure like Leicester and tossing it into different characters on the stage. And Malvolio is one where we can certainly see this member of court is being fragmented and parodied and, you know, taken a piss at. Again, with the potty humor on stage. And then, of course, the members of court are watching this performance. And
laughing.
Yes, because one thing is that this glancing illusion, it requires audiences to have a knowledge of extra-textual references and recount history from their memories and identify likeness. So while today we wouldn't necessarily pick up on Malvolio being a caricature of sorts of this aging lover, this aging favorite of Elizabeth's, the early modern audience very well would have picked up on that because they have all the context.
Right. And that's incredible that theater was such a liberating art form that you were, even in that time, allowed to kind of, even though the people knew it, make fun of these courtiers to their faces in court.
Right. You just couldn't make it too obvious, right? Because then you would get in trouble.
Yes, definitely. Shakespeare seems to have hit that balance pretty well. Well, we don't have too much time left, but is there anything else that you wanted to share about Shakespeare's performances at court, maybe under the reign of James or anything else under the reign of Elizabeth?
I've got like one quick thing about James.
Please,
is that with James, we get two plays that are like definitely written for, like, with the intent to be performed for a Stuart audience, with Henry VIII and Macbeth. Mm. They have a lot to say about what does it mean to be a person in power and what does it mean to be worthy of power. And James entertained a lot wider variety of plays in his court, whereas I think I said earlier that Elizabeth preferred comedies. But James was really interested in this, like, dialogue of what do the people think about me? How do I be a good ruler to English people? And the plays brought him those thoughts, those answers. And I mean, Macbeth specifically is a lot of writing about Scottish history and kind of making a case for a Scottish English king.
Right. Yeah. And if people want to listen to more about that, they can go back and look at our episode from season one of this podcast where we talked with you about King James and Macbeth, for sure.
Right, right, right. Plays for the court just get really popular under James. Indoor theater gets super popular. So we see, when we look through, like, the long line of time, we see that indoor theater gets super popular. More indoor theaters are built, which is great because it really sucks to produce theater in the winter in England.
Yeah.
Outdoors, you can do a lot more when it's indoors.
Right.
Which is a lot of times when these plays were performed for the court. And by the time we get to the next king of England, indoor theater's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
So
is that Charles? Am I
James
right
just kind of Charles. So it's called Carolinian England.
Yeah.
So after Shakespeare died, so after Shakespeare's death, a few years later, everybody's all about indoor theater.
Because wow. James Shakespeare was the hipster popular. Getting in on the ground yeah. for indoor theater. Well, and so if people want to listen to your podcast, this episode won't be airing for another few weeks, obviously, but do you have any idea what plays you'll be delving into next? Can you give us some clues there?
So right now we are in the middle of our Hamlet series. So we are, by the time this comes out, we'll be about halfway through with Hamlet. And we know what we're doing for our next play.
This will probably come out in early September, probably now. So people can go ahead okay. and head on over to the Shakespeare Anyone podcast, which obviously I will link in the description below so that people can check out the podcast and listen to all of your previous episodes and see what's next to come. Thank you for joining us. And we can't wait till the next time Great. We talk to you.
Thank yeah. you so much for having us.
Thank you so much for tuning into Scurvy Companions, the No Sweat Shakespeare podcast. No Sweat Shakespeare is a literary education website devoted to making Shakespeare more accessible. Visit us online at nosweatshakespeare.com to read play summaries, monologue and character analyses, Shakespeare history, and more. And follow us on Facebook and Instagram at No Sweat Shakespeare and on Twitter at Easy Shakespeare. We hope you'll join us again next time.